This week here in Chutz Laaretz, we're reading Parshat Shlach, but we're going to talk about something that affects all of Bamidbar. As a matter of fact, just for Dovi's sake, I'm going to actually start it with Korach. No, it's okay, because the truth is that the beginning of Korach is kind of a good way to start this. I'm going to share the source sheet here. We'll take a look. What I'd like to do is to take a look at all of Sefer Bamidbar. Today is going to be kind of a broader look at Sefer Bamidbar. Parshat Shlach has one little piece in it which is very troubling, which leads to this particular problem. But the truth is that all of Sefer Bamidbar really suffers from this, and we'll take a look at it. And if you want to give this a different kind of title, you could call it Ein Mukdam Mu'char B'Sefer Bamidbar. In a little while, I'll get to why that's an appropriate title. But I think that more of the issue is that what the order is, Seder U'Musar B'Sefer Bamidbar. And the premise is as follows. Sefer Bamidbar is not in chronological order. And I'm going to show that to you several ways. It is explicitly not in chronological order, as you can see from source 1 and source 4. And that's the one that the Gemara Pesachim in the middle of the first parak uses to prove Ein Mukdam Mu'char B'Torah. The Ramban, who is the famous devotee of Yesh Mukdam Mu'char B'Torah, and goes at it against Rashi and against Ibn Ezra and against Midrashim, when he claims, for instance, that the Mishkan was commanded before the Egel, because that's the order in which the story appears, and that Yitro showed up before Matan Torah, because that's the order in which it appears. Those are two of the famous machlokot, where everybody else, or a lot of others, say Yitro came after Matan Torah. That's why Moshe was judging the people to show them how to do the mitzvot, and that the Mishkan was a kapara for the Egel, and it came afterwards. And so even the Ramban has to, and he does, concede the point about these two particular passages in Sefer Bamidbar. If you take a look at source 1, you'll see by the Ba'al Adonai Moshe b'Midbar Sinai, b'Ohel Moed, b'Achad l'Chodesh HaSheni, b'Chan Rashi HaSheni, the Sitam Yer Tetzrayim L'mor. In other words, Hashem speaks to Moshe. We're going to get to the highlighted part a little bit later. But for right now, look at the date. The date is the first day of the second month, the month that we call ER, but second month, in the second year. This means this is a year and 2 weeks after we left Mitzrayim. If you go ahead to Perek Tet, and this is the explicit one in your face, but the truth is many of these are explicit. By the Baruch Adonai Moshe b'Midbar Sinai, b'Shana HaShenit, l'tzeitam me'eretz Mitzrayim, b'Chodesh HaRishon le'mor. And now Hashem speaks to B'nai Yisrael sometime, as we know, in the first half of Nisan, meaning a month earlier or less, but certainly earlier. The reason I say or less is all we know from Pasuk Bet is that he says this in advance of Korban Pesach. And then that leads to people showing up and saying, we will not be able to bring the Pesach because we're Tameh, and that opens the door for Pesach Sheni. But that means that chapter 1, to use the nomenclature, chapter 1 begins in, we'll call it May, just to have fun, and chapter 9 begins in April, a month before, which tells you right away that at least those two sections are not in order. Now, here's the challenge. Anytime that you find, whether it's the Ramban in those few cases where he has to admit it, or everybody else in all the cases where they maintain Ein Mukdam Mu'char B'Torah, they've got to then explain why are things out of order, because the most natural way to tell a story is in order. And if you're going to modify the order, and I'll give an example from Bereishit, something out of our context today, just to sort of keep it parav. If you're going to put something out of order, there's got to be a very good reason for doing it. Well, at least a good reason. So the example I'll give you is as follows. In the story, middle of the story of Yosef, Yosef is sold, and while he's being sold, we're holding our breath, there's a whole story about Yehuda and Tamar that takes place in a different place. Away from Yosef, away from Potiphar, away from Mitzrayim, away from Ishmaelim. There's a whole story about Yehuda and Tamar, an entire chapter, chapter 38. Now, if you read through the text, you will discover that it is almost impossible. I'm familiar with Seder Olam, and it's almost impossible to say that that happened then. Meaning, Yosef was sold, and at the very most, there are 22 years, and I say at the very most, I'll explain why. At the very most, there are 22 years between the point that Yosef is sold and the family comes down to Egypt. The reason I say at the most is because when we first meet Yosef, we're told that he's 17. When Yosef rises to power, the text says he's 30. There are 7 years of plenty. There's the second year of the famine, which means Yosef's 39, when the family emigrates to Egypt, which means that if Yosef was sold when he was 17, then there's 22 years. If Yosef was sold a little later than that, maybe he was 19 or 20, there's less than 22 years. Okay, I'll grant you 22 years. The story of Yehudah cannot have started after the sale of Yosef, because Yehudah meets a woman, gets married, has two kids, and then later on, with a gap, a third kid. The first kid becomes old enough to marries, and is sinful, and God kills him. The next brother is old enough to do Yibum, and minimally that's 13, but maybe a little older, and he messes up, and God kills him too. The third kid is significantly younger, and we wait a while until he grows up, and then Tamar realizes that that kid is never going to be allowed to do Yibum on her, and then Tamar goes and does what she does. Peretz is born, 9 months later, Peretz and Zerach, and Peretz's son is listed among the people who went down to Egypt. To have all that happen in 22 years, impossible. And that's why the Rabag says very simply, the story of Yehudah started much earlier. In other words, the years overlap. It's not 22 years in the middle. While Yosef is in Egypt, all of this happens. Meaning, while Yosef is a slave in Egypt and viceroy without the family, that all this happens. Not happening. And so therefore, you got to ask the question, so why didn't the text put this earlier? And the answer is because it's trying to teach you a lesson. They're teaching you a lesson about Yehudah and his relationship with the brothers, about Yehudah and his relationship with the people. Whatever the lesson is, not my problem now. This is not a shiur on Yehudah. But whenever you see that Ein Mukdam Mukhar, you got to ask why. And so that's what we're going to kind of devote our time here in looking at Bamidbar in a broader kind of analysis. Okay, so Perek Aleph, Perek Tet, as you can see, happens earlier. However, that's not the only problem in Bamidbar, even explicitly. Let's look back at Perek Chet in Source 3. In Source 3, Perek Chet, which is, of course, before Perek Tet, and this is right after the menorah. This is the first big unit in Bahalotcha. It is about the dedication of the Levi'im and sanctifying them for their job. When did that take place? So we have to posit that that took place before Rosh Chodesh Nisan, because after all, Aharon and his sons are stepping into the position of running the Mishkan, and the Levi'im are supposed to be there to help them. There's no reason to believe that the Levim were an afterthought. Oh, we see that Aaron and his sons can't run things. Let's move the Levim up. And the Levim are already dedicated to the work of the Mishkan before Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which means now Perek Chet happened before Perek Tet. So now we've got Perek Chet happening first, then Perek Tet, and then Perek Aleph. Okay, good. Now, we're not done with this, because we move backwards again to Perek Zion. And that's in Source 5. And notice I'm running backwards and forwards here. That's the whole point about Ein Mukdam Mukhar. Look Source 5, which is Chapter 7. Chapter 7, by the way, is the longest chapter in Chumash. 89 psukim, of which, as we've said before, about 66 of them are superfluous, because it's the repetition, 6 psukim each, of the gifts given by the Nesim, which is exactly the same gift. The only variables are which day it is, what shaven it is, and the name of the Nasi. That's it. Exactly, letter for letter, tom for tom, the same exact thing. This happens when? Vayhi biyom kalot Moshe lahakim et hamishkan, which means this happens on Rosh Chodesh, or perhaps Erev Rosh Chodesh Nisan, when Moshe has finished constructing the Mishkan, and we're about to dedicate it, starting with the first day of Nisan. So you see that we don't even have an order that we can identify. It's a zigzag. It's not like it runs backwards. It runs forwards, it runs backwards. And there must be some other rhyme or reason to what's going on. Now, I'm going to show you one more thing, and then we're going to take a look back at these highlighted words and a very significant Rashbam here. In Perek Gimel of Bamidbar, after the census. Remember, the census is Perek Aleph, that very long Perek that does a census of every tribe. And then at the end says, but don't count the Levim. And then Perek Bet, which does another census of the tribes, but sets them up by camps, and that the Levim will be in the middle. Perek Gimel is devoted to the Levim. Ve'ela toldot Aharon Moshe, b'yom diber Adonai Moshe, behar Sinai. We're going to look back at that phrase, behar Sinai. Ve'ela shmot bnei Aharon ha'bechor Nadav. Now, if we are in, let's say, Bamidbar mode, Perek Gimel, which is part of the unit with Perek Aleph, it seems, is happening in Er. Let me ask you, who are Aharon's sons in Er? The answer is Elazar and Itamar. Nadav and Abihu have got last names, and their last name is Aleihem HaShalom. Nadav and Abihu aren't around anymore. So how do you say Ve'elishmot bnei Aharon ha'bachor Nadav, v'Abihu Elazar v'Itamar? And notice it doesn't then immediately say, but Nadav and Abihu are dead. It says Ve'elishmot bnei Aharon ha'makonim ha'mshuchim shmei Eidam l'chahen. And then in Pasuk Dalet it says, Vayamot Nadav v'Abihu lifnei Adonai v'akrivam eizara lifnei Adonai. B'midbar Sinai. Now notice, B'midbar Sinai, as opposed to the introduction of this parsha, which is Behar Sinai. We're going to focus on that in a minute. Now, if you're taking a census, why are you counting dead people? Doesn't make sense to count Nadav and Abihu, Elazar and Tamar, and then say, sorry, Nadav and Abihu are dead. Doesn't make any sense. So, the Rashbam, you take a look at it in source 2. There's the Rashbam at the beginning of Bamidbar. Makes an interesting observation, and we're going to use this observation to widen our net even beyond Bamidbar. He says the following, Kol hadibrot shenamru b'shana rishona kodem shuhukam ha-mishkan. Anything Hashem said to Moshe during the first year before the Mishkan was up, which means from the minute we left Egypt until the end of that year, until the Mishkan was up, or Kodesh Nisan of the next year. Katub Bahen Bahar Sinai. All of them say Bahar Sinai. They're introduced as, what location was it? Bahar Sinai. And the notion is either on top of the mountain, or perhaps at the foot of the mountain, but the mountain. Aval Mishukam HaMishkan Bechad L'Chodesh B'Shana Shniyah, but when the Mishkan was erected on the first day of the first month of the second year, Lo ye'amer Bahar Sinai, it will no longer say Bahar Sinai, aval b'midbar Sinai and or b'ohel moed. And he's being very methodological about this, of saying the Torah is using specific terms to identify location. Bahar Sinai means on top or next to the mountain, because that's where God is talking to Moshe. Remember, the purpose of the Mishkan was to be a place for Hashem to speak to Moshe and continue the Har Sinai experience in Ohel Moed. So he says, whenever it says B'midbar Sinai, it may or may not add B'ohel Moed, it means B'ohel Moed, which means you can now identify a time factor. Any mitzvah which is given B'har Sinai was given sometime before Rosh Chodesh Nisan of that year. And any mitzvah which is B'midbar Sinai and or Ohel Moed was given afterwards. Okay, and now watch how he proves his point. V'chein mochiach lefaneinu, back in the Rashbam. Dichtiv ve'ele todot Aaron Moshe, b'yom diber Adonai Moshe, b'har Sinai. Right, these are Aaron's sons when Hashem spoke to Moshe, b'har Sinai. Kodem shehukam ha-mishkan. Before the Mishkan was erected, we have four sons of Aaron. Aza yutodot Aaron arba. Good. But once the Mishkan was already erected, then there's only two. Now look back at source 6 and you can see it. Who were Aaron's sons when Hashem was speaking to Moshe? Behar Sinai. And if you remember, when Moshe went up to the mountain, he took Nadav and Abihu with him. And it says, Nadav, Abihu, Elazar, v'Itamar. Good. And then Pasuk Dalet shifts and is, Vayamo Nadav, Abihu, l'fnei Adonai, b'akivam, esar, l'fnei Adonai, b'midbar Sinai. That is after Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and now there's only two sons, right? So that's the distinction, all right? And so therefore, the Rashbam to conclude, b'midbar Sinai yor ba'al v'sof shnayim kivo b'yom shukam o ha'moed metu nadav aviyu. Very straightforward. So now, in source 7, which is the Rashbam's commentary directly on the counting of Nadav and Avihu, she said, "Shezehu kodem shukam haMishkan az hayu arba'a, aval b'shana shniya shukam Mishkan mimbar Sinai lo nisharukim al azar v'tamar kmo shefarashti l'mala v'tchilat parsha." Rashbam says, "I already told you this. Shalom, why are you copying it again? I just want to show you the Rashbam takes this methodology very seriously." Okay, very good. But what that means is that even within a short little passage of few psukim, we're switching time. Now, the switching time here is forward from Bahar Sinai to Bimidbar Sinai. But remember, the census starts Bimidbar Sinai. Right? Now, if you remember it, we go back to the beginning of Vayikra. How does Vayikra start? Vayikra, let's take a look at it in passage 12. We'll come back to this in a minute. Vayikra Moshe v'adabar Adonai lav me'ohel mo'ed le'mor. Hashem commands Moshe regarding the korbanot me'ohel mo'ed. How does the chapter 25 in Vayikra start? V'adabar Adonai Moshe behar Sinai le'mor. Which means the end of Vayikra happens before the beginning of Vayikra. Okay, we're going to see more about that in Vayikra, but for right now, in Bamidbar. So, taking a look further in this week's parasha, or in last week's, if you're in Eretz Yisrael, Shlach, right after the story of the Meraglim, of the and the punishment given to them, the very next thing we have is a series of mitzvot. And the mitzvot, and this is part of the problem, is the mitzvot that exist in Bamidbar. When were those mitzvot given? And I'll give you one quick example. In Bamidbar, you have a big parasha, 34 psukim, I think it's 34 psukim, which is all devoted to the para aduma. It's devoted to tumat meit, tumat ohel, tahara, and the punishment for entering the mikdash if you are Tamei. A lot of details. These details do not exist anywhere beforehand. Which means if you're reading this in a linear fashion, you could come to the conclusion that at some point in the desert, and by the way, it seems to be the 40th year already, Hashem gave this new mitzvah of Tumat Ohel and of Tahara. That, of course, is impossible. First thing is, Nadav and Avihu themselves died. And what was Moshe's reaction to Nadav and Avihu dying? He told Mishael and El Safan, their cousins, to take them out of the Mikdash. Elazar and Itamar can't touch them. Why? Because they'll become Tamei and won't be able to continue the Avodah. And why do the bodies have to be taken out of the Mishkan? Besides the obvious aesthetic reason, because of Tumah. You don't have to go that far. You can go very simply in Bamidbar. When people come up to Moshe, we don't know how many people, come up to Moshe and say, we can't do the Korban Pesach, because we're Tamei LaNefesh. That means Tumat Meit exists. Okay. But there's an assumption that within a month they will be no longer Tamei because they'll get Pesach Sheni, get a chance to do it. How are they going to become un-Tamei? Through a procedure. What procedure? We'll tell you about it later. No, I don't think so. Meaning the laws of Parah Adumah already exist. The laws of Tumat Meit exist and Taharami Tumat Meit exist. Which means then we have to ask a fundamentally different question. Not why were these mitzvot given now, because they weren't. But why did Hashem tell Moshe to write it where he did? And for that, we have lots of different case-specific lessons. Mitat tzadikim, mechaper korbanot, it's like to the death of Miriam, could be other associations. But that means that when we read Sefer Bamidbar, specifically with regard to the mitzvot, we can't necessarily read it as if it's happening in that order. Take a look, for instance, at this comment of the Ibn Ezra on the mitzvah of Nisachim, which is the first mitzvah given in linear fashion after the story of the Meraglim, after the Meraglim and the big failure of the Mapilim. The first thing we're told is when you come to the land, you're going to bring korbanot. You have to bring with the korban, you have to bring the sachim. So you have to bring a mincha, which is shemen, and shemen zayit, and dagan, and you have to bring tirosh, you have to bring wine. Okay, Ibn Ezra. Nismacha zota parasha, source 9. Al shenechleshu vayitablu. Why was this parasha here? Because the people felt terrible. To comfort them so that they should come to the land. Okay? V'hanachon, he said, I think what's correct is, Bavur shenasu kol ha'ida v'chatu. They all called out and they sinned. They said, we want to go back to Mitzrayim. And Yitzlach lahem bavur tefilat Moshe. And Moshe's tefillah brought about forgiveness. Amar v'chi tishku v'lo tasu. That's why the next mitzvah given is challah, and then afterwards, talks about korbanot brought for making mistakes, things that you regret. And in that parasha it says God will forgive. In other words, the Ibn Ezra is saying, why is this parasha put here? It's put here by association, thematic association, with the fact that Bnei Yisrael sinned, asked to be forgiven, were forgiven, and now here is an example of how that will happen in the future. When you err, even in something as egregious as Avodah Zarah, and there'll be a vehicle for forgiveness. Now, the way that Ibn Ezra presents it, it sounds as if these mitzvot are given here. But now I'm going to show you something that, if you haven't seen it before, is guaranteed to blow your mind. One of the seminal events in Bamidbar is, of course, Mei Merivah. Is Bnei Yisrael are wandering. Miriam is dead. At least the setting of the text, Miriam is dead, Bnei Yisrael are wandering, and they are already very close to Eretz Yisrael. By the way, perhaps they may be technically inside of Eretz Yisrael in Midbar Tzin, and they have no water, and they complain, and Hashem says to Moshe, take the stick. We all know the story. Kachata Mateh. Now, we're looking at Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor. A quick introduction to Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, whose popularity is, thank God, on the rise, after many centuries of not being well-known. Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor is part of that very precious group of three generations or so of Mefarshei HaPshat in northern France, which of course starts with Rashi. Rashi's grandson was sort of like the next generation of that, the Rashbam. And the Rashbam had a student, Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor. He was Rabbi Yosef of Orleans. He's mentioned in Tosfot, but he was a famous Mefaresh that explained Pshat. And he often had quite innovative approaches to things. For reasons that are beyond what we could talk about here, most of the really remarkable Mefarshei HaPshat did not make it in the popularity contest. And their writings were not necessarily preserved. In some cases, we're still working for manuscripts. In some cases, we're still piecing together from how they're quoted by other Rishonim. But there's been a revival of interest in Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, Rabbi Yosef Kara, and Rabbi Eliezer Bojansi, and other of these great Chachamim. So Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor says the following. That's his quick introduction. Put him in the middle to the end of the 12th century. L'fi ha'nireli, zehu ma'aseh shebavayhi v'shalach. Listen to what Bechor Shor says, because it's wild. He says, this story of Moshe, the stick, the punishment, not being able to enter the land for whatever reason, all the list of all the things that Moshe did that people compiled, is the same story, not a repeat, it's the same story as the story that appears in Shmot. If you remember when Bnei Israel are in the Midbar on their way to Har Sinai. They first cross Yam Suf and they find water and the water is stagnant and Moshe throws a stick in and makes it sweet. And then the man. And after the man, there's another story of thirst. And the people are testy and angry with Moshe. And Hashem tells Moshe to take a stick and hit the rock and water comes out and everybody drinks. And it's very nice, except they call the place Masa Umerivah because the people tested and quarreled with God. All right? Good. Now, watch the Bechor Shor. L'pfi hanir ali, zel ma'aseh shebavahi v'shalach t'chtim bei v'kita v'atzur v'yetzu mayim. This is the same story. Hashem, there's thirst. They're in the desert. But this is at Har Sinai now. not in the Negev somewhere. It's in Har Sinai. And Hashem told Moshe, take a stick and hit it, and the rock word will come out. The purpose of B'Shalach and the purpose of Shmot, that part of Shmot, is to teach how HaKadosh Baruch Hu took care of Bnei Yisrael with food and with water, etc. And then each one of those components gets written later. By the way, where is the story of the Slav repeated? It's repeated in Parshat Balotcha. But there it's repeated with a very negative angle. We'll come back to that. Where is the story of the man told? In Parshat Balotcha. Both of those are complaining stories. And later on in Chukat also. And he says the story of the water is now told, which means all three things happen before they get to Har Sinai. The water from the rock, the man, the slav, and it's presented from a perspective of welfare. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took care of Bnei Israel. In Bamidbar, we hear other pieces of the same story, the negative side of the same story. Okay. You should know, he's emphasizing it, it's the same story. Now, by the way, he knows that he is flying in the face of Midrashim. He's flying in the face of Chazal. He's flying in the face of other Mefarshim and saying this. Mefarshei Pshat are like that. They will take a position and they'll stand with it. In Shmot, it says, they called the place testing and quarreling. When Moshe gives his brachot, right? When it comes to Shevet Levi, he said, Asher nisito b'masa tirivehu almei meriva, and that's talking about the case where Moshe was told he can't come into the land. And that makes reference to the same words used in Shmot. Masa umeriva. Al de masa echadu. See, it's one story. V'afachantiv heim mei meriva kadesh midbar sin. It says at the end of this parsha, it says, those are the waters of meriva. It's also midbar sin. So he says sin and sin is just variations on the same word. Geographically, we seem to know differently, but watch what he's saying. Shalom piresh kan piresh sham. In other words, what it didn't say here, it said there. What it didn't say there, it didn't say here. It's what the Chazal say. Divrei Torah ashirim aniim b'makom achad v'ashirim b'makom acher. One place fills in the information the other place doesn't give you. Shamar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'hakot batzur. Meaning in Shmot, Hashem told him to hit the rock. Which, by the way, now leads the Bechor short, I have to say. What Moshe did wrong wasn't hitting the rock, because that's what he was told to do. And a whole list of things. Chen derech parshiot harbei. Look what he says. This is consistent that the Torah will explicate something in one place and leave it ambiguous in another place. And you got to use one to fill in the information from the other. And watch what he uses as an example. Kegon Parshat Miraglim. Now, if you look in this week's Parsha, Parshat Shlach, you see the story of the Miraglim. And by the way, whose idea was it to send the Miraglim? It seems to be Hashem's idea or Moshe's idea. But in Dvarim and Perak Aleph, it's presented as Bnei Yisrael saying, we want to send people. So his position is that this is not a one-time deal. This happens consistently in the Torah, where the same story is told twice from different perspectives. Parenthetically, and this is a very important parenthesis, so maybe I should take the parentheses off. Here he is in the 12th century, and he is anticipating, in a sense, and I'm sure, hopefully not, I don't think consciously, but he's anticipating the arguments that Wellhausen is going to make at the end of the 18th century and beginning of the 19th century, which are that you see different versions of the same story. It must be different sources, different traditions, PED, etc. And he's, in a sense, anticipating, but I think a little bit better, is Rav Breuer's whole position of shtei bechinot, of saying that the same story or the same law will be told in two different places in the Torah to give you two perspectives on it. And Rav Breuer could have been building on this. I want to use that to get us to the Mekoshesh, and then, which is in Parshat Shlach, and then take a look at something that's not even in Bamidbar. So do the Mekoshesh, talk about Bamidbar for a couple minutes, and then show you how this is a broader issue. At the end of Parshat Shlach, almost the end, because the end is tzitzit, We have a story of a mikoshesh. Out of nowhere, in the middle of all those laws, Nesachim, and Chala, and how do you call it, and Chatat for Avodah Zarah, etc., we suddenly have mikoshesh. It's a story. And what happens in the story? They find the guys collecting wood on Shabbat. Now, we all know the story. I'll just quickly paraphrase it. The people who found him bring him to Moshe. They put him in a lockdown because they don't know what to do with him. And then Hashem comes and says he gets skila. Well, from a perspective of halacha, juridical procedure, this is untenable. Because one of the staples, and those of you who were in the Zoom shiur, this dive shiur this week, remember this, one of the staples of the court is that witnesses have to be able to testify that the criminal not only was warned explicitly about what they were doing, but was warned with full information as to the nature of the violation and the specific consequences for the violation. And if the person doesn't say, I know I'm going to get skila for this, and I don't care, I'm going to go ahead and do it again, you can't give them skila. Here, in this case, it's very clear that they didn't know what to do. Nobody knew what to do because they locked them up, and they waited, and Hashem then said, okay, get skila. How did they give the guy skila? So what I suggested a few years ago, and I still stand by it, is that the mikoshesh is, and I'm using the B'chor Shor's typology here, the mikoshesh here is the other piece of a story in Shmot. Just like the rock. In Shmot, we hear a story in the context of the man. Bnei Israel get the man. It's beautiful. They're blown away. The stuff from yesterday didn't go bad. Beautiful. The first Shabbat, it's wonderful. And the next week, on Shabbat, people go out to collect man. And Hashem gets very angry. And, Ruuk Yadonai, Natan Lachem a Shabbat. I've given you Shabbat. It's a great gift. Don't violate it. Hashem is angry. But we don't hear anything about what happens to the guys who went out to collect man. What I'd like to suggest is that's who this is. Mekoshesh is that guy way back then, before we got to Har Sinai, who went out to collect man on the 14th day since the man fell, the second Shabbat. Because it's filling in the story, which of course explains now why nobody knows what to do with him. They haven't gotten those laws yet. And all of the procedural stuff hasn't happened yet. So if Hashem says, give him skila, give him skila. Now, the reason I'm mentioning that is because here you see another example of something which didn't happen now, but nonetheless is put here. Why is it put here? It seems to be put here because the passage just before, which is talking about korbanot brought when somebody makes a mistake, somebody sins in error, then talks about va'ish asher yaseh biyad ramah. If somebody does a crime flagrantly, then ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And here we have a great example of the guy acting flagrantly. So beautiful piece of example. Don't think people don't act that way. Here's a guy who did act that way. Remember a year ago in the desert, the guy acted that way. And here it is. So what we see is in Bamidbar, certainly it's the case that Sefer Bamidbar is not in order. So what is the order of Bamidbar? So I'm going to take you to the header of this whole page. When you look at the first 10 chapters, it is a festive piece. And the workbook that I use at school, that I make for the students in school, the first 10 chapters all have a header, moving up. Moving up. Moving up, Nazir, moving up, Chanukah to Mizbeach, moving up, the Levim, moving up. And then when we get to chapter 11, everything is called moving down. You read it, you see. Bamidbar, Naso, and the most of Baalotcha is festive, it's exciting. Towards the end of Perek Yod, there's a custom even in many shuls to read the Masaot, the travels with the Shira tune. The Al-Tzvam HaTeim and Hashem, etc. Right? The festive tune because it's a festive feeling. And then you get those two backward nuns facing each other, and inside is what's the culmination of the festivity. The culmination of the festivity is by he bin soa haaron by yomer Moshe kuma adonai yafutzu evecha yanusu misanech barecha. All of these chapters have been leading up to a glorious march into Eretz Israel and a glorious conquest led by the Aaron. And then, of course, the rest of it is the reality. And the reality is, perhaps best typified, by contrasting that picture of the Aron going out to war with the picture at the end of the story of the Meraglim, when the people go up to fight, the Aron brit Adonai u'Moshe lo mashu mikar machaneh, the Aron and Moshe stayed in the camp, and they lost. The people lost. They were wiped out, the Ma'apilim. So what you have is the first 10 chapters. We're not concerned with them being linear. We're concerned with them presenting a picture, and the picture of the first 10 chapters of Bamidbar is, this is what the camp should look like. This is what the march should have been. From Perek Yud Aleph on, here is a collection of stories that tell you how it was. It wasn't all great. By the way, it wasn't all bad. And there were responses. There were challenges to leadership. There were punishments. It's something we've talked about in the past. When did Korach happen? Korach very likely happened before Chanukah Tamishkan. Because, of course, what kind of fools would take Torah in their hand after Nadav and Avihu were killed and said, okay, I'll be part of a test. That's right. So there's lots of reasons to argue that some of the stories that happened in Bamidbar happened at an earlier time. They're put there to describe this is the real thing. Picking up on the Bechor Shor's image methodology, this is the real thing that happened in the Midbar. It wasn't all bad. And read Yirmiyahu Bet, Lechtecha Charai Bamidbar Be'eretz Lo Zura is pictured as a beautiful time. Look at Hoshea Bet. It's a romantic time of relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but there were challenges. Things were not perfect. And of course, the big one was the Meraglim, which led to a whole generation having to die out. And so it's presented that way for an educational purpose. We read Bamidbar, we're not reading a travelogue. That's Parshat Maaseh. We are reading an image of what could have been, what should have been, and what was. And if you think that's unprecedented, I'd like to draw your attention to Sefer Bereishit. When you read Perek Aleph of Sefer Bereishit, what do you read? You read a story of creation. You read Perek Bet, meaning Perek Bet, Pasuk Dalet on to the end of Perek Bet and Perek Gimel, what do you read? Another story of creation. Do the two stories sit harmoniously? Only with a lot of stretching. They're not harmonious. Did creation take 7 days or 6 days? Did it take 1 day? Was woman created with man or from man? Were animals created before man or afterwards? Is man's job to have dominion or to be a farmer? We're familiar with the difficulties. So the Midrash addresses it. And the Midrash addresses it from a different perspective and says, in the first story, of course, the name used for God throughout is Elohim. And in the second story, it's Hashem Elohim. And the Midrash says, Bitchila ala b'machshava, originally God's intent, whatever that may mean. Livroata olam midat adin. He wanted to create the world according to a strict measure of justice, which means you mess up, you're gone, finished. Ra'ash ein ha'olam mikayem. He saw that the world could not last that way. Shiteif imo midat harachamim. He included. He didn't substitute. He added midat harachamim. Hashem Elokim. What does that mean? That means chapter one never happened, according to the Midrash. Chapter one was a plan. Chapter one was an ideal. Chapter one was, to borrow from the Midrash, the blueprint. Chapter two is what actually happened. That's the Midrash. And so you have that model already as early as Bereishit. You see the same model in Bamidbar. This is what should have been. This is the ideal. This is the image. And this is what actually happened. Real people with real problems, real fears, real jealousies, real challenges. And sometimes the challenges are good, like Benot Slavchad, and sometimes the challenges are awful, like Datan and Avira. But real life. The interesting thing is that this phenomenon is not limited to Bamidbar. I gave one example from Bereishit earlier, which is, you know, just for interest, that this other one from Bereishit is not about linearity, but about ideal versus real. But I want to draw your attention, end the shiur, to the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. And remember what the Rashbam said, and by the way, the Rashbam repeats it here, is that every time that a command says Bahar Sinai, that refers to things that were given before there was a Mishkan. When it says Bemidbar Sinai, that's in the Mishkan. So take a look at the beginning of Vayikra. Vayikra Moshe, Vayidaber Adonai Elav, Me Ohel Moed Lemor, which means these mitzvot are given in Ohel Moed. Right? They constructed the Mishkan, and Hashem calls Moshe. Moshe can't go in. The cloud, end of Shemot. Moshe then hears these mitzvot, the mitzvot of Ola, of Mincha, of Shlamim, of Chatat, and of Hashem. Beautiful. All right? And these are all given in there. And then we get to the beginning of Parshat Tzav, And Savatar, when we assume that Parshat Tzav, because we read it, also has details of the Olah and the Min, etc. And we assume, okay, Parshat Tzav is some other perspective on the Korbanot than it is. You think about it, Parshat Vayikra is the perspective to donors. You want to bring a Korban, it's the kind of animal to bring. Make sure it's this old, make sure it's perfect, make sure male, female, etc. Right? Bring the breads with it, whatever. Tzav is the instructional manual for the officiants. Here's how the Kohanim, once you're handed the Korban, here's what you do. Okay. Notice, by the way, the order in Tzav is a little different, as you can see in the blue highlight. Mincha, Olah, Mincha, Chatat, Hashem, Shlamim. Now, at the end of Tzav, what does it say? Zot HaTorah, which, by the way, in an interesting typo, ended up as V'lat Todah in a song that some of us sing on Yantif. But Zot HaTorah, La Olah, La Mincha, V'la Chatat, V'la Hashem, V'la Meluim, V'la Zavah HaShlamim, Ashet Tziva Adonai Moshe, Behar Sinai. Where did Hashem give this mitzvot? Behar Sinai, which means before the Mishkan. Well, I thought you said in the beginning of Vayikra it happened in the Mishkan. What is it? And then watch, to make it more confusing, it says, "B'yom tzavotor b'nei Yisrael akriv korbanayim l'Adonai b'midbar Sinai." On the day that he commanded b'nei Yisrael to bring their korbanot, b'midbar Sinai. Which is it? And the Rashbam picks up on that. And he says in source 15, "Uvasof ha-mikra omer b'midbar Sinai, ekev titchilat mitzvat ha-korbanot haya b'har Sinai." Hashem's original commands about korbanot happen on top of the mountain. Teremu kama mishkan, v'kribo kasher yukama mishkan. Right? In other words, here's what happened. Up on top of Har Sinai, Hashem commanded Moshe about the mishkan. That's clear. Hashem commanded Moshe about Bigdei Kuna. That's clear. Hashem also commanded Moshe regarding sanctifying the Kohanim. It's in Parshat Tetzaveh. And how are the Kohanim sanctified? They have to bring a mincha, they have to bring a chatat, they have to bring a shlamim, they have to bring an olah. So all of those laws were already given, how to do those things. What laws weren't given? What laws weren't given were, if a regular person wants to bring a korban, what do they bring? And so the beginning of Vayikra happens afterwards. The beginning of Vayikra is, ooh, now that we've got a Mishkan, if a Jew wants to come and bring a korban, here's what he can do. He wants to bring an olah? Good. He has to bring a male, has to be this old, has to be, it can be from the herd, from the flock, etc. It can be a bird. Person wants to bring a mincha, here's the different options that exist. Person wants to bring a shlamim, here's all the different things that are involved. And then in some circumstances, you'll be obligated to bring a chatat or an asham. And then the Torah writes material that was already given earlier on top of Har Sinai, which is how to perform these korbanot, which had to be given because setting up the Mishkan involved a dedication ceremony with korbanot. They had to know how to do. So what you see here is that even at the beginning of Vayikra, the presentation is not chronologically accurate, meaning Hashem didn't say Perak Aleph and then say Perak Bet. Hashem said Perak Aleph through Hey, and earlier had said Perak Vav and Zion. And so why are they set up? The Torah is not a history book, and the Torah is not a transcription of words. The Torah is God's guide to how we have to live. How we have to live, what we have to do, what we have to avoid, the kind of attitudes and values we have to internalize, the way we have to treat each other, the whole picture. And therefore, it will place things in sequence in a way that will be meaningful towards that message. In a purely halachic sense, we have an interesting machloket among the Tanaim about whether dorshim smuchim, whether juxtaposition means anything in the Torah. However, interesting, Rabbi Yehuda, who says it doesn't, says in Dvarim it does. Why is Dvarim the iconoclast here? Why is Dvarim the outlier in which order actually makes a difference? Because Dvarim is an ordered speech. And Moshe gives that speech in order. And there, the order of things is intentional. And therefore, if things are juxtaposed, that's a meaningful thing. Juxtaposition in the other books may be motivated by other considerations. And therefore, lo dorshim smuchim. Okay? So that's just a look at Bamidbar. Hopefully a little bit of an insight into the very big divide that those double nuns kind of create for us, and to go from there.